Washington's Farewell Address. Washington's farewell address, issued as a public letter in 1796, was one of the most influential statements of American political values. Drafted primarily by Washington himself, with help from Hamilton, it gives advice on the necessity and importance of national union, the value of the Constitution and the rule of law, the evils of political parties, and the proper virtues of a Republican people. In the address, he called morality a necessary spring of popular government. He said, "Reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle," making the point that the value of religion is for the benefit of society as a whole. Washington's public political address warned against foreign influence in domestic affairs and American meddling in European affairs. He warned against bitter partisanship in domestic politics and called for men to move beyond partisanship and serve the common good. He called for an America wholly free of foreign attachments, saying the United States must concentrate primarily on American interests. He counseled friendship and commerce with all nations, but warned against involvement in European wars and entering into long-term entangling alliances. The address quickly set American values regarding religion and foreign affairs. Retirement and death. After retiring from the presidency in March 1797, Washington returned to Mount Vernon with a profound sense of relief. He devoted much time to farming and in that year constructed a 2,250-square-foot distillery, which was one of the largest in the new republic, housing 5 copper stills, a boiler, and 50 mash tubs at the site of one of his unprofitable farms. At its peak, 2 years later, the distillery produced 11,000 gallons of corn and rye whiskey worth $7,500, and it produced fruit brandy. On July 13, 1798, Washington was appointed by President John Adams to be Lieutenant General and Commander-in-Chief of all armies raised or to be raised for service in a prospective war with France. He served as the senior officer of the United States Army between July 13, 1798 and December 14, 1799. He participated in the planning for a provisional army to meet any emergency that might arise, but did not take the field. On December 12, 1799, Washington spent several hours inspecting his farms on horseback, in snow and later hail and freezing rain. He sat down to dine that evening without changing his wet clothes. The next morning, he awoke with a bad cold, fever, and a throat infection called quinsy that turned into acute laryngitis and pneumonia. Washington died on the evening of December 14, 1799, at his home, age 67, while attended by Dr. James Craik, one of his closest friends, and Thomas Lear V, Washington's personal secretary. Lear would record the account in his journal, writing that Washington's last words were, "'Tis well." Modern doctors believe that Washington died largely because of his treatment, which included calomel and bloodletting, resulting in a combination of shock from the loss of 5 pints of blood, as well as asphyxia and dehydration. Washington's remains were buried at Mount Vernon. To protect their privacy, Martha Washington burned the correspondence between her husband and herself following his death. Only 3 letters between the couple have survived. During the United States Bicentennial Year, George Washington was posthumously appointed to the grade of General of the Armies of the United States by the Congressional Joint Resolution Public Law 94-479 of January 19, 1976, approved by President Gerald R. Ford on October 11, 1976, and formalized in the Department of the Army Order No. 31-3 of March 13, 1978, with an effective appointment date of July 4, 1976. This restored Washington's position as the highest-ranking military officer in U.S. history, which had been undone when General John J. Pershing was made General of the Armies at the end of World War I. Legacy. Congressman Henry Lee, a Revolutionary War comrade and father of Civil War General Robert E. Lee, famously eulogized Washington as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. He was second to none in humble and enduring scenes of private life, pious, just, humane, temperate, and sincere. Uniform, dignified, and commanding, his example was as edifying to all around him as were the effects of that example lasting. Correct throughout, vice shuddered in his presence, and virtue always felt his fostering hand. The purity of his private character gave effulgence to his public virtues. Such was the man for whom our nation mourns. Lee's words set the standard by which Washington's overwhelming reputation was impressed upon the American memory. Washington set many precedents for the national government and the presidency in particular. As early as 1778, Washington was lauded as the father of his country. He was upheld as a shining example in schoolbooks and lessons, as courageous and far-sighted, holding the Continental Army together through 8 hard years of war and numerous privations, sometimes by sheer force of will, and as restrained. At war's end, taking affront at the notion he should be king, and after 2 terms as president, stepping aside. Washington manifested himself as an exemplar of Republican virtue in America. More than any other American, he was extolled for his great personal integrity and a deeply held sense of duty, honor, and patriotism. He seemed more as a character model than war hero or founding father. One of Washington's greatest achievements in terms of Republican values was refraining from taking more power than was due. He was conscientious of maintaining a good reputation by avoiding political intrigue. He rejected nepotism or cronyism. Jefferson observed, "The moderation and virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish." Monuments and memorials. Washington is commemorated on the quarter. Washington is also commemorated on the dollar coin. Today, Washington's face and image are often used as national symbols of the United States, along with the icons such as the flag and Great Seal. Perhaps the most prominent commemoration of his legacy is the use of his image on the $1 bill and the quarter dollar coin. Washington, together with Theodore Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln, is depicted in stone at the Mount Rushmore Memorial. The Washington Monument, one of the most well-known American landmarks, was built in his honor. The George Washington Masonic National Memorial in Alexandria, Virginia, constructed entirely with voluntary contributions from members of the Masonic fraternity, was also built in his honor. Many things have been named in honor of Washington. Washington's name became that of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And the state of Washington, the only state to be named after an American, Maryland, the Virginias, the Carolinas, and Georgia, are named in honor of British monarchs. George Washington University and Washington University in St. Louis were named for him, as was Washington and Lee University, once Washington Academy, which was renamed due to Washington's large endowment in 1796. The Confederate seal predominantly featured George Washington on horseback, in the same position as a statue of him in Richmond, Virginia. Washington and slavery. George Washington grew hemp as a crop on his plantation. For most of his life, Washington operated his plantations as a typical Virginia slave owner. In the 1760s, he dropped tobacco, which was prestigious but unprofitable, and shifted to hemp and wheat, growing and diversified into milling flour, weaving cloth, and distilling brandy. By the time of his death, there were 317 slaves at Mount Vernon. Before the American Revolution, Washington expressed no moral reservations about slavery. But by 1778, he had stopped selling slaves without their consent, because he didn't want to break up slave families. In 1778, while Washington was at war, he wrote to his manager at Mount Vernon that he wished to sell his slaves and to get quit of Negroes. Since maintaining a large and increasingly elderly slave population was not economically profitable, Washington could not legally sell dower slaves, those that belonged to his wife, however. And because these slaves had long intermarried with his own slaves, he could not sell his slaves without breaking up families. Washington was the only prominent slaveholding founding father who succeeded at emancipating his slaves. He did not free his slaves in his lifetime, however, but instead included a provision in his will to free his slaves upon the death of his wife. Not all the slaves at his estate at Mount Vernon were owned by him. His wife Martha owned a large number of slaves, and Washington didn't feel he could unilaterally free slaves that came to Mount Vernon from his wife's estate. His actions were influenced by his close relationship with the Marquis de Lafayette. Martha Washington would free slaves to which she had title later in her own life. He didn't speak out publicly against slavery, argues historian Dorothy Tuhigg, because he didn't wish to risk splitting apart the young republic over what was already a sensitive and divisive issue. Religious beliefs. Washington was baptized into the Church of England. In 1765, when the Church of England was still the state religion, he served on the vestry, lay council, for his local church. Throughout his life, he spoke of the value of righteousness and of seeking and offering thanks for the blessings of heaven. In a letter to George Mason in 1785, Washington wrote that he was not among those alarmed by a bill making people pay towards the support of that religion which they profess, but felt that it was impolitic to pass such a measure, and wished it had never been proposed, believing that it would disturb public tranquility. His adopted daughter, Nellie Custis Lewis, stated, "I've heard her," Nellie's mother, Eleanor Calvert Custis, who resided in Mount Vernon for 2 years, "say that General Washington always received the sacrament with my grandmother, Martha Washington, before the Revolution." After the Revolution, Washington frequently accompanied his wife to church services. However, there's no record of his ever taking communion, and he would regularly leave services before communion with the other non-communicants, as was custom of the day, until he ceased attending at all on Communion Sundays. Prior to Communion, believers are admonished to take stock of their spiritual lives and not to participate in the ceremony unless he finds himself in the will of God. Historians and biographers continue to debate the degree to which he can be counted as a Christian and the degree to which he was a deist. He was an early supporter of religious toleration and freedom of religion. In 1775, he ordered that his troops not show anti-Catholic sentiments by burning the Pope in effigy on Guy Fawkes Night. When hiring workmen for Mount Vernon, he wrote to his agent, "If they be good workmen, they may be from Asia, Africa, or Europe. They may be Mohammedans, Jews, or Christians of any sect, or they may be atheists." In 1790, he wrote a response to a letter from the Toro Synagogue, in which he said that as long as people remain good citizens, their faith does not matter. This was a relief to the Jewish community of the United States, since the Jews had been either expelled from or prejudiced against in many European countries. Personal life. In addition to Martha's biological family noted above, George Washington had a close relationship with his nephew and heir, Bushrod Washington, son of George's younger brother, John Augustine Washington, who became an associate justice on the Supreme Court after George's death. As a young man, Washington had red hair. A popular myth is that he wore a wig, as was the fashion among some at the time. Washington did not wear a wig. Instead, he powdered his hair, as represented in several portraits, including the well-known unfinished Gilbert Stuart depiction. Washington suffered from problems with his teeth throughout his life. He lost his first tooth when he was 22, and had only one left by the time he became president. According to John Adams, he lost them because he used them to crack Brazil nuts, although modern historians suggest it was probably the mercury oxide he was given to treat illnesses such as smallpox and malaria. He had several sets of false teeth made, four of them by a dentist named John Greenwood. Contrary to popular belief, none of the sets were made from wood. The set made when he became president was carved from hippopotamus and elephant ivory, held together with gold springs. The hippo ivory was used for the plate, into which real human teeth and also bits of horses' and donkeys' teeth were inserted. Dental problems left Washington in constant discomfort, for which he took laudanum, and this distress may be apparent in many of the portraits painted while he was still in office, including the one still used on the $1 bill. One of the most enduring myths about George Washington involves him as a young boy chopping down his father's cherry tree, and when asked about it, using the famous line, "I cannot tell a lie, I did it with my little hatchet." In fact, there is no evidence that this ever occurred. It, along with the story of Washington's throwing a silver dollar across the Potomac River, was part of a book of stories authored by Mason Weems that made Washington somewhat of a legendary figure.